So, Kim Bailey, thank you very much for having a few words with us on NCCR. Tell us, how did you get started in horse training?
Well, bizarre, really. I was born in Essex's, my father was a farmer and trained a few horses for his friends, and I just grew up enjoying the horse world rather than the farming side, and so it sort of carried on from there, really.
Yeah.
I then went to school, and when I finished school, I ended up working for a trainer in Newmarket, and always too big to go and ride flat horses, I ended up driving a horse box to and from the race meetings and saddling and becoming his assistant. And from Newmarket I then went to Wantage and worked for Captain Foster and did 2 years there. And from there onwards I went to work for Fred Ryman in Worcestershire, and shared a house with Nigel Twiston Davis and Sam Maudshead, and we had three pretty interesting years there before I set up my own.
Yes, so really speaking, your kind of interest was almost in your blood from birth.
Yeah, very much so. And I think, I'm very lucky to be doing something which I get paid for being a hobby. And, I've done it for such a long time and been involved with the horse racing world since the day I was born, really. So it is an extraordinary way of life. And it has its ups and downs, as we all know. But, I mean, it's a fascinating business to be involved in.
Yeah. You were just referenced to being too tall to be a jockey, did you say?
Yeah, no, I'm 6 foot three, and I currently weigh X. I might have been X minus five by the time I was late at school. But, I had a couple of rides under rules. Actually, I had six rides under rules and I think five rides in pointer points. But even when I was 17, I remember finishing second at Market Raisin, beaten by local trainer Jim Wilson in virtually a photograph, and I hadn't eaten for a week and spent most of the time in a sauna. And when I got off the horse, I collapsed on the ground, and I decided that was most probably it.
That was my jockey's career.
I think most probably any other jockey who ever rode against me in those days would have been delighted to see me pack up.
Yes, you could have been the other Longfellow, couldn't you?
Yes, I could have been if I was thin enough, but there are plenty of jockeys who are taller than me over the years. I employed a chap called Alan Jones who rode Mr. Frisk in his early days, and he was as tall as me, there was nothing of him, and he used to do 10.5 stone quite comfortably.
Yes, 10.5 stone. That's a while since I've seen that. It must be quite challenging for jockeys to keep their weight.
Well, it's a big problem for them, because at the end of it, the biggest problem they have is the fact they've got to try and keep their weight going, especially at this time of year when they're not probably getting as many rides as they would do during the winter. And to live on a treasured diet of basically nothing, it's hard to keep your enthusiasm when you're hungry and seeing your friends enjoying a night out, eating and drinking, and you're saying, no, I can't because I got a ride and I haven't got one for 2 weeks.
Yes, that can't be funny, can it? Can you remember the first horse that you trained as a winner?
Oh, of course I can. It was a horse called Shifting Gold. He won at Sandown and he was ridden by John Frankham.
There you are now, you see. I thought that would be an easy question, really, because I guess the first of anything for any of us, really, is sort of indelibly.
Well, I think the first and last are the things you always remember.
Yes.
And the things in the middle might get drifted away a little bit.
Yes, and you can remember the high points. So what was the last one?
Well, the last one was a horse called Manila Warrior who won at Warwick.
Which was?
A couple, 6 weeks ago.
6 weeks ago, yep, so there you are. And you've got quite a few horses at the stables now, haven't you? How many horses?
Well, we have room for 70. We've got about 55 in here at the moment. We've got horses coming back from their summer holidays at the moment, so we've still got quite a few, obviously, to come back. Some of the owners keep them and ride them around before they come back to us, or they send them somewhere else for pre-training before they come back to us. So hopefully, once they're all back, we'll be up to full strength and off we go.
Yeah. And how do you decide which horses to race?
Well, basically, that if you treat every single horse like a human being, they arrive here as 11-year-old children and leave here as 21-year-old adults, if you want to put it that way. So we start off with a youngster who hasn't had any experience. They get broken in, they get brought along quietly. And some horses will come together very quickly and show immediate ability and strength to be able to run. So those horses will run. Some will take a little bit longer, so they might not run their first season. And then they gradually get stronger and become more mature with the whole operation. And the more strength they get inside them, the more times they're able to race.
And I noticed as well from your website, there's a charity partnership, and you have one of your current partners is Maggie's charity, isn't it, in Cheltenham?
Yes, it's something we did. It's actually just come to an end as such. We did 2 years with it, and we raised, I think, best part of £30,000 for Maggie's cancer homes in Cheltenham, which has been a really good success. The horse is no longer part of the charity, although it'll carry on running under Maggie's name to help them collect the publicity out of it if the horse turns out to be any good.
Okay, yeah, I've got you. So presumably you take on like a partnership of that sort every now and again, or is that kind of...
I try and do a charity partnership every 2 or 3 years for the simple reason it helps the benefit of the charity. I started some years ago with I had a jockey called McNamara, JP McNamara, who had a very bad fall at Bangor and injured his back, and it was touch and go whether he was ever going to race again, let alone, well, he certainly wasn't going to race again, whether he'd ever walk again. And the doctors were very, you know, very quick to say that he was unlikely to walk again. So I got in touch with a chap called Bill Shankid, who was a you know, complete paraplegic, and was paralysed from his neck down, who was a friend of my father's, and a couple of other people I knew, and said, look, this is something we ought to try and raise some money for him. And the interjockeys were very helpful to JP himself, and we tried to work out some other way of making some money to help him. So we set up a charity fund, and we set up a charitable racing club which was raising money for spinal research. And we raised £160,000 for spinal research during that period, which was, I think, one of their biggest fundraising operations. And it got a lot of new people into racing. We did various functions during the year, which was very successful. So it's something that we've carried on. And then we did one for Help the Heroes. And the reason I did that, because Guy Disney, who's obviously local around here, his father was my doctor, John Disney, and Guy I knew because he used to come and ride out here, and he was the only person I knew who went to Afghanistan, obviously, because I, you know, don't know that many people in the army, and obviously, unfortunately, he lost his injury, you know, he had an injury and lost his leg, so from the knee down, and we got very involved in that, and I remember going to see him in hospital in Selly Oak, and so we set up the one for Help the Heroes, and we raised, I think, £60,000 for them. Sadly, the horses weren't a great success, but still the charity benefited enormously from it. And Guy, as we all know, has gone on to remarkable things. You know, he's ridden Winners Under Rules, he's he's been the North Pole, South Pole, you name it. I mean, he's an extraordinary individual.
Does he live locally?
He does, yes, he lives locally, and his parents live just outside Naunton, which is only a few minutes from here. And so, yeah, we see him. He comes and rides out here. We had a horse for him last season, and we got the horse for him this coming season as
Sounds like a suitable subject for an interview at some point. So that's a very, that's... I did wonder about the, you know, the charitable the charitable arrangements there. Now, I noticed there's some little graphic around here that says you've had winners on every race course in the country.
That is correct, yes, I have. And the last one to crack the bolt was Hexham. Funnily enough, it was the one that I started off at, but without having a winner. Lots of trains have done it, but it was quite a nice thing to go and do.
Yes, like a full house, isn't it?
It's a full house, yes. And, you know, the Foss Lass was obviously the last race course to be built, so therefore we luckily cracked that one quite early on. So.
Yes, that was handy. That was handy.
But I've been to every race course, but I have not been to Cartmel.
Right.
Sadly, which is the one I miss.
Yeah. So how about for those of us that are uninitiated in these matters? I mean, there's point-to-point racing, and then there's hurdles, isn't there? And then there's the fences. So presumably horses kind of progress through those, do they? Is that the way it works?
They progress through those and they go the other way. So point-to-pointing is an amateur sport run under amateur rules. Horses have to qualify with a local hunt to be qualified to run in point-to-points.
Right.
Point-to-points are run under the guise of jockey club rules, so you can't go in and dope your horses to make sure they go faster. So it is all a case of making sure it's for older horses retiring to keep a career going, or younger horses coming through. It's becoming quite a successful business over here. It's hugely successful in Ireland, where people go and buy young horses and bring them on quietly, and then sell them to us with vast fortunes of money after they won their point to point. When it comes to national hunt racing, we have we have national hunt flat races, which are flat races run under our rules for horses who have never seen a race course before. Then we have hurdle races, which are half the size of a fence. So that's a graduation onto fences, which is the bigger ones, which you see.
And what are these races called? Bumpers?
Bumpers are national hunt flat races. They are, in Ireland, they originally started as for young horses to run that have never seen a race course before, and that means every sort of race course, bar a point-to-point. And they had to be ridden by by amateurs.
Oh, right, OK.
So they became bumpers, because amateurs bump around in the saddle.
since
we started them in this country, we actually have them for conditional jockeys and professional jockeys, so they're slightly different.
Right, OK, yeah. I just wondered about the origins of the phrase.
I'm afraid, like everything in life, once you get stuck with a nickname, you're stuffed.
Yes.
And bumper is a bumper.
Yes.
Because the people bump around the saddle.
Yes, and bumping each other, on the course, I should imagine.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yes, I'm afraid to say. It's the nearest thing to banger racing.
Yeah, that's right. And then the other phrase that just crosses my mind was, like, selling races.
Yeah, selling races, they're more prevalent on the flat racing side than they are jump racing. So you can enter a horse into a race, and everything in that race is for sale. There's a guideline price that they can be claimed at during the race, but the winner actually goes up for auction after the race.
Oh, right, okay.
And then you have the chance of buying it or buying it back, whichever.
Yes.
And the race course takes, I think, about 85% of the prize money that
money.
So the race courses at one stage really enjoyed having them, because it's a great form of, great form of revenue.
Yes, yeah. And so, and actually your horse has shown itself to be a winner.
And it's shown itself to be a winner, yes. Yeah. It's not necessarily the ideal time to ring up your own and say, I'll win a race, but it'll be a seller, then you've got to buy it back afterwards.
Yeah, it's not quite so funny. So you've had some big successes as a trainer, haven't you? What with the National, Mr. Crisp in 1990. Mr. Frisco, I say Crisp. That's another horse.
Yes, and there was a horse called Crisp, an Australian horse who was second in the National. That was the Red Rum. That was most probably the most iconic race of ever, really, because if you remember, Crisp and Richard Pittman went about a fence and a half clear at one stage and were still a long way clear jumping the last, and the old horse's legs tired coming to the line, and this little monster came past him and caught him on the line. So, it was one of the saddest things ever, but also one of the great moments in racing.
Rather like Devon Lock.
Very similar. I mean, the great thing with the National, there's always a little story about it.
Yes.
To this day, no one really knows what happened to Devon Lock, whether the shadow he saw of the water jump or what, but he jumped a non-existent fence or looked as though he did.
Yes.
Interesting.
It had got to him. And then another race that I remember from, history. Foynaven sort of rounding all those horses that went down at whichever fence it was.
The smallest fence on the course, and one horse refused in front and turned sideways. The next horse ran into back of him, the next horse ran in the back of that one. And Foynaven, who was quietly tootling around the back door with Johnny Buckingham, managed to come round the outside and win the race. And I remember that as a child, because I was very young at the time, and Johnny Buckingham used to come and ride out for my father. And I had my £1 each way and won it 500-1. It was extraordinary.
That's a good win.
A good win. It's a memorable moment in my life. I shall never forget watching it. In black and white, obviously.
Yes.
It still is.
And it's one of those races where, if you've got nothing else to do, as it were, and you don't normally gamble or whatever, and you think, now, if I was a gambling person, where would I put my money, and put a pin in? But on this particular day, let me think of the name of the horse. Ben Nevis.
Yep. Trained by Tim Foster.
Ridden, who was that was one of yours?
Yes, it was the person I worked for, yes.
Yep. Ridden by?
Charlie Fenwick.
Correct. Fenwick is my father-in-law's name, so my wife is a Fenwick, you see. And I remember thinking, Ben Nevis, tallest mountain in the UK, Charlie Fenwick, oldest rider. In my head, I kind of saw a headline, and of course that horse won, didn't it?
It did.
It was quite an amazing win for that. So you think, why didn't I put a few pounds on that?
you talk about names and why people back horses or whatever, and it's the same with trainers. I mean, I had a horse I bought in Northern Ireland some years ago called Betty's Boy. And I buy a lot of my horses on spec and try and then sell them onwards. And I was struggling to sell the horse because of the name.
Yes.
And then I had a chap ring up out of the blue and said, I see you've got a horse called Betty's Boy for sale. Can I buy it? So I said, of course you can. And he bought the horse and had a huge amount of success with it. He won at the Cheltenham Festival. Mm. And I remember asking why he called it. He said, my mum was called Betty and I was her only boy.
Betty's Boy.
Betty's Boy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the kind of emotional, sentimental kind of attachments. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you've had some nice success at Cheltenham itself, haven't you?
Yes, no, Cheltenham's been, certainly over the years, it's been a really good race course for me. I've been lucky enough to win the Gold Cup with Master Oates and Alderbrook with the Champion Hurdle. And, there's a measured moments. Betty's Boy, who we're talking about, he also won at the Cheltenham Festival. So the festivals is a part of racing life, really. It is the most important, on those days, 3 days, now 4 days of the year. And if I can stand on the top of a hill here and say, I've got a horse that I can sell you that will win at the Cheltenham Festival, I'll be knocked over, or even run at the Cheltenham Festival. It is a sort of iconic moment in racing. It's quite extraordinary how the power it has. It's a phenomenal race course. It's a beautiful race course.
Yes,
wouldn't be a person in the country who doesn't dream of going there.
That's right, or winning there, particularly.
Yeah.
Yes, that would be the trick, wouldn't it, to win. And so, do you have any kind of, what should we say, ambitions? You've done all the race courses, you've won the key races as a trainer. Do you have any kind of ambitions left?
Oh, you definitely have ambitions left. I long to win a Gold Cup again. I really would. I mean, I think that's the most iconic and the greatest races. You know, if you're a tennis player, you want to win at Wimbledon. If you're a racehorse trainer who trains national horses, it is to win the Gold Cup. And yeah. I would just dearly love to do that again.
Well, you've done it once already, so...
Yes, and I have to say that that once is never enough, is it?
No, I guess not. You've got to do it twice, haven't you?
Yeah, and then you won't do it a third time.
Yes, it's rather like Del Boy and Rodney saying that this time next year Rodney will be millionaires, and they become millionaires, and they say, well, they've lost the reason to live.
Yeah.
You know, and Del Boy says, no, we want to be billionaires.
Yeah, that's
you know, that's the kind of way...
One shouldn't be greedy.
No. You've got to be realistic as well, haven't you?
You have.
I mean, because you've had enough of the downs to know that things are never quite always on the way up, are they?
Life is a graph that goes both ways.
Absolutely, and if you can't hack the if you can't hack the downs, then really you oughtn't to be in it at all, ought you?
No.
So there you are. So do you have any kind of like musical choices?
Well, strangely, I went to listen to Neil Diamond on his last concert, which I thought was quite extraordinary for a man of his age to go and have the voice he had.
Yeah.
Another person I listened to quite a bit is Paloma Faith, which might slightly surprise you.
Why should it surprise you? Yes, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, I had an owner of mine, a chap called Bill Ives, who was celebrating his 70th birthday, and he had taken a room in a Dorchester hotel in London. And Paloma Faith, who I'd never heard of, came and sang at his private audience for half an hour.
Yes.
She was an interesting person. She had a phenomenal voice.
Yes.
Her comments during and after the performance were something I shall never forget, really. She's become very popular. And
every time you hear the voice,
you have a memory, don't you?
I've seen her, yes, yeah. I've seen her before.
It was a good evening, and I think she sings remarkably well. You know, she's an Essex girl, isn't she?
So, oh, well, there's the link, you see, there's the link. And in fact, usually when you see a performance of any sort of music, it does have a whole different feel, doesn't it, to just hearing a record or...
Undoubtedly. I mean, anybody my age have done Tina Turner's and various other ones, and, you know, Madness, you were talking about them before, I've been to see them, and lots of... I mean, a live music festival, any description is always quite interesting.
Yes.
You know, we have one down here, the 2000 Tree Festival, not that I went to it, because there's music I've never even heard of, and the noise up here was enough to put you off, so...
Yes, I have a job defining garage music, house...